Listen here, wolf child. I speak to you of the science of mythology. I speak of Maverick Deviation, the psychotronic love commandos. We shall be drunk on stars, we shall fear nothing. Demand the impossible. Dream your destiny. Defy the logic of alphabets. I slayed the king of the wolves. Nothing is impossible.
But are you yourselves cartoon characters? Are there other persons behind these Zodiac Mind Warp persons and Slam?
Yes, we do exist in cartoon land. Yes. Have you ever seen the film Twilight Zone?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, we're from cartoon land. Mm-hmm. That's where we live, the fifth dimension.
Welcome to Rock and or Roll. I'm your reluctant host, BJ, and I'm very pleased to be joined once again by author of many great KISS books, Julian Gill. I guess that's maybe you're tired of being associated with KISS every time anyone talks to you. I don't know.
Well, I think last time I got lucky because I was associated with the Def Leppard book. So
yeah, right.
You know, here we are again, and thanks a lot for having me back on the show. It's always great to talk to you about music.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. And yeah, you did the High and Dry episode with me, and of course you have the Leopard Tracks book. And I'm very excited for your new book that's coming soon about music from the Elder called Odyssey, which I can't wait. So that's going to be great. But we're here today to talk about, well, of course, this whole podcast is happening because we were on the, I think it was when we were on the podcast together where somehow Zodiac Mind Warp came up. And there aren't a lot of people that are big Zodiac Mind Warp fans. So when you said that, I think you listed him as one of your top favorites. And I immediately said, well, we got to do an episode of my show about Zodiac Mind Warp because I love it too. So it seemed perfect.
Yeah, that was really funny. I mean, that episode of podcast was a blast. We were, I think, doing the episode on the Gene Ace, Peter and Paul book. And it just comes out of left field sometimes. It's like, what are you listening to? And it's like, oh, Zodiac Mind Warp. And there was silence from the others, and you were like, oh, and it's like, okay, cool, you know. there's probably about 10 people who know about Zodiac Mind Warp. It's really one of those kind of niche things, so it's going to be really fun to talk about him and the band.
Yeah, well, that's the kind of thing I love to do on the podcast. So I mean, it seemed like, I mean, come on, I can have Julian Gill on to just talk about Zodiac Mind Warp. That's the exact kind of thing I like to do with the show. So, but yeah, I'm guessing probably the vast majority of people that are going to hear this don't even know who Zodiac Mind Warp is, but you're in for a treat when you start hearing some of these songs. I was going to ask you, what do you think, what percentage of Zodiac Mind Warp is Spinal Tap or Steel Panther, do you think?
Oh, it's pretty high up there.
Yeah.
It was all up there. I don't think he was ever supposed to be taken seriously.
Right.
I'm going to go, I think Nigel, this one goes up to 111%.
Except the thing is, though, the songs are so great that they obviously took that very seriously and were big fans of that kind of music at the same time, even though it was... So I've seen it called self-parody. You know, they're kind of making fun of themselves, you know, as much as anything else.
Yeah, you know, it's definitely parody. But you know what? There's a lot of good songs there, as you said. But go back to Spinal Tap as that connection there. There's a lot of good songs in Spinal Tap as well. You know, good music is good music. Who cares if it's born out of, you know, parody, mockery, whatever. You know, good music's going to catch you with a hook, with a lyric, and, you know, that's what hooked me, so.
Yeah, I think you could say the same thing with Spinal Tap and Steel Panther, that they're also fans of what they're making fun of, you know, at the same time, which is probably why fans of that kind of music don't get offended by it. We just enjoy it because, you know, we're all in on the joke to a certain extent. So
it's very dangerous for a rock and roll band to take yourself too seriously, because that just sucks the fun out of what you're supposed to be doing. And when you think about what rock and roll is, I mean, it's so many different things, but number one, it's about rebellion, being different, having fun. And what a better way to do it than, you know, make fun of yourself and have fun doing it.
But you can imagine at the PMRC hearings, if they had pulled out some Zodiac Mind Warp lyrics, gotten all offended and not realizing that that was kind of the whole point, you know.
Well, they didn't have a sense of humor, so that was their first problem.
Right. Well, my introduction to Zodiac Mind Warp, I remember very well. It was the Prime Mover video on Headbangers Ball, which when I was probably like 14, and I watched the band drive a tank through the wall of like a Catholic boarding school, turn all the Catholic schoolgirls into groupies with like rays from their eyes. And then at the end of the video, the nuns come storming in and Zodiac explodes their heads. So that was my introduction to the band.
And that's, you know, that's such a catchy one. Mine's a little bit different, and I'm going to bore you with a little bit of a longer story to set the stage for this. You know, it was just happenstance. 1987, I'd been living in America for 8 years. My parents' marriage went to shite. My father had buggered off to Singapore. And I was a nasty teenager. I mean, shock and horror to anyone who actually does know me. I'd gone off the rails. I was like hanging out with the John Bender crowd, riding dirt bikes, with people on the back of them with guns shooting animals that we then take home and eat. So I was given two options. I can go to Singapore and live with daddy, or go to boarding school back in England. I chose number two, go back to England. And I had to go out there and get interviewed for this boarding school. And while I was out there, I hit the record stores. You know, I went to Penny Lane Records in Liverpool, found some great, you know, Quiet Riot, Randy Rhoads bootlegs, you know, Wasp, Animal Fucked Like a Beast, the 12-inch, which wasn't too widely available in America. Then I went to this little thrift market place in Southport. I was buying Kiss stuff. But up on the wall was a copy of the Prime Mover single. So just like you, Prime Mover, but I don't remember there being a video. And there's that dude on the cover of the single with that untamed stare. I was just like, okay, that looks interesting. Bought it. And 30 years later, here I am. I'm doing a podcast with BJ talking about Zodiac Mind Warp.
Yeah, so you just bought the Prime Mover single just, you know, to check it out. And yeah.
Yeah, it was just one of those things. I mean, remember in the old days, you'd go into a record store and you'd be flipping through records and you'd find something different, just something that caught your eye. It's something that we miss on the iTunes generation, digitally buying singles or, you know, buying songs. It was just one of those things. It was... Obviously, he was more popular in England at that time. It was just an impulse buy and one that, you know, hooked me. So, bloody hell.
Yeah, that's the younger generation, I'm sure, can't imagine having to buy something just to be able to hear it. But yeah, that's the way it used to be.
You just roll the dice and buy an album, and sometimes you'd like it. Sometimes you might take a song and put it on your mixtape, and other times it'd be one that you'd try and trade off or would collect dust for the rest of its life.
So Zodiac Mind Warp himself, I guess, is this guy Mark Manning, who, I mean, he was like a graphic designer for heavy metal magazines and stuff, I think, and a cartoonist maybe.
Yep.
And then he decided to, I mean, I guess he was a fan of this kind of music, and he decided to make his own music, but he, you know, he went in this, like, over-the-top kind of direction, invented this character and this whole mythology. And he also writes these books. Before we started recording, we were talking about the Fuck by Rock book, which, I mean, it's got to be just 100% fiction, right? Isn't it?
You know, my problem with Fucked by Rock, and that is the only one of his books that I've got, is that I either did not drink enough absinthe before trying to read it, because I couldn't get into it. I'm obviously not fucked by rock enough to read Fucked by Rock. So I have no idea on the truth of the matter. It's just interesting writing.
Well, it's like if you took The Dirt by Motley Crue and just took it to the most insane extreme. You know, it took like their most ridiculous story in The Dirt, exaggerated it, and made a whole book like that. that's kind of what it's like. It's just all these crazy drug and sex stories that, yeah, I don't really think any of it's true. I think it's all just the characters he created and the mythology of the whole thing.
I mean, it's probably about as real as, let's say, a Kiss comic book.
Yeah. Or The Dirt. It's probably about as real as The Dirt.
Yeah, I don't, you know, The Dirt, well, that's his own thing.
Yeah. So he has other, yeah, I'm the same as you. The only one I have is Fucked by Rock. He has a few other books, too, which I'm guessing are probably pretty similar. I don't know. There's like a tour diary. And I guess they probably toured in the UK. I don't think they ever did much over here in America, though.
They did a North American tour in, I think it was 87 or 88. They toured with Guns.
Oh, so, really?
Yep.
Wow.
There was recently on eBay, and I missed it, there was an itinerary from that tour up. And I mean, they started in Canada. It didn't look like a very big tour, but, you know, all those years ago, I don't remember the other details of what they actually did. I know they did quite a bit of touring in Europe.
So Mark Manning puts together this band. The first thing they released was Wild Child, right? Which is just like a 3-song EP.
If you want to ride my rocket ship, baby, first you gotta light the fuse.
Yeah, that came out in 85, and, you know, it's glorious, actually, in a kind of strange kind of way. It's the first of 6 billion versions of the Wild Child track. And, you know, it's a 9-minute version called the Crunchdown Destroyer Mix. And I like it. I mean, it's endearing. It's fun and dumb. And it sounds like the shit I play on my guitar, so.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's not stellar production, but it's, and for 85, it's a pretty interesting time for this. It's this kind of period in between, like, early 80s metal and when the whole hair metal, glam metal thing really became huge. And so he's, and I mean, you know, a lot of times Zodiac Minor was called like sleaze rock or whatever. So it's that kind of thing. It doesn't really fit in with heavy metal, but there really wasn't a lot of stuff, you know, that much like it yet. So it's kind of you know, in 1985, what exactly was he parodying even? Because,
you know, I'd hate to throw it out there, but you can probably think of some of the big, obnoxious, arrogant rock artists who were pompous. Probably Motley Crue, probably more of the British acts, maybe even the Cult, who knows?
Yeah, right. But, you know, since this is even before Guns N' Roses, or, I mean, even before Poison or anything, basically, so.
Yeah, so in that sense, he's well ahead of the curve. You know, and he's doing things. I mean, Wild Child itself as a song is pretty much straightforward rock. There's not a lot of, let's say, art rock that, like, is going on in Psychoactive or the, you know, the songs on the B-side there. You know, that's a bit more artistic or experimental. So who's he parodying? Hard to tell, but he's, you know, straight out of the gate, he's doing his kind of his unique thing.
And then, so then the next thing after Wild Child is High Priest of Love, right?
No, there is a track that was included on a Food compilation. Food was his record label at the time. And they put out a sampler of lots of their artists called Imminent 2. I don't know when it came out. And it's got the studio version of Drug Shoes on that album. And it's one they played live, and it shows up on their compilation a bit later on. But that's the only source I know for that song. And it's you know, it's actually a pretty decent track, and give it a little bit of a listen. That's a rare one.
Yeah, so High Priest of Love is basically another EP. It's just, six songs. And there's like you were saying, there's a lot of versions of Wild Child. There's another version of Wild Child on there. Probably my favorite song on High Priest of Love is Dangerous. I think that's probably the hookiest song for me.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on that. It's in my list right here. I like this. I've had quite a few copies of this over the years. I've had like three of the LP. I've got a Canadian cassette and I've got a Swiss CD of it. And of course, even more interesting on this is what was the only CD source for a long time is, I think it's the title track shows up on Return of the Living Dead Part 2 soundtrack.
Oh.
So I'm also a big fan of High Heeled Heaven on this. Love it.
Yeah, all the songs in this are fun. I mean, this is it's not the best production, maybe. I mean, it's kind of lo-fi or...
Yeah, you know, it almost needs that disclaimer, not very produced. You know, it's rough, it's raw. I don't know how many tracks they were using in the studio here, but it's certainly not much more than a band playing, you know, and getting the songs down. They're not tarting it up very much, and it's like... cut it, record it, press it, sell it. So one thing I do want to say on High Priest of Love is there are songs on this that just sound abso-fucking-lutely monstrous on the Weapons of Mass Destruction live CD.
Right, yeah.
That's a little bit further down the road. We'll be right back.
Yeah, I'm looking at the cover of High Priest of Love, and I'm thinking back then you're going to have like a Sisters of Mercy fan or somebody like that is going to pick this record up, and then maybe maybe it won't be quite what they were expecting.
But you know, I picked this up, actually. I thought it looked a little like Ian Asprey, The Cult.
Right, yeah.
If you think of how he was looking in Dreamtime and maybe during the Love era, you know, I saw that cover, and again, you don't really see the text until you get up close, and it catches your eye, and you think, oh, maybe it feels Nephilim or something like that. It's a bit of a camouflaged item.
Yeah, and another thing I'm thinking of from around then is, you know that EP by Specimen, Batastrophe?
That one I don't know, actually.
Yeah, I think it's from, like, 83, and that looks similar, and it's not as metal, but it's in a similar vein of this, and they were a UK group, I think, too, so yeah, I guess I never thought about Zodiac Mine were fitting. I mean, obviously there's like cult connections, but yeah, there was a whole different not as hard rock type thing going on in England at the time that he almost could have been lumped into as well, which is weird to think about.
Yeah, you know, it's a little bit, and to be totally honest, I'm not that well versed in the history anymore. I've forgotten a lot and just didn't follow up on it. But kind of like the Bradford art rock scene, you know, I know Asprey was a bit of, you know, on the fringes of that, obviously Southern Death Cult and all that stuff that came earlier. But there was a kind of similar theme of band going in England at the time, and I guess you know, be fair, let's say Britain.
But then when you move on to the major label record, Tattooed Beat Messiah, for me this is kind of a quantum leap. This is such a great album, and so many great songs on this record. It's kind of mind blowing how awesome it is.
You know, that's what makes it one of my desert island discs, for want of a better phrase. A lot of those things had been out on singles in England the year before it actually came out. But once it comes out, they've polished up the sound, they've got production values, they've kind of fixed the image up a little bit to make it a little bit more mass marketable. But the album itself, from start to finish, it's like an experience. I mean, all those little intermission vignettes, the Wolf Child speech at the beginning,
yeah,
the Messianic reprise at the end, it's trying to do what a lot of bands had forgotten how to do. And I hate to throw in the Kiss reference, you know, with Destroyer, but to be a piece of music that has a beginning, has an end, and he's got his rallying cries in the middle. And I love having the Wolf Child howl as a ringtone. That really annoys people on the bus.
Yeah, this record is, it transcends any parodic elements or like tongue-in-cheek or whatever, because you know the songs are so good. I mean, there's a lot of funny lyrics and, you know, over-the-top lyrics that obviously are like that on purpose, and they're not 100% serious, but the songwriting is very serious. Obviously they took writing these songs very seriously, and these are very well-written songs for this genre, about as good as it gets, really. You know, like we were talking about Prime Mover or, you know, Driving on Holy Gasoline. I mean, that's as good as it gets for this kind of stuff. We'll be right back.
Absolutely. And you've just got another one that I've got written down, you know, as one of my keys on this album. There's an attention to the arrangements on this that it makes it more than just a throwaway. And that kind of takes it above being a parody or a gimmick or anything that we kind of said at the beginning about, you know, the essence of the band. They care about the words. You know, Mark has a great vocabulary and knows how to turn a phrase and say something that's witty, that's cutting, that's well structured, that's twisted, and you know, the humor, tongue in cheek, you know, words. Zodiac or Mark Manning knows how to use them.
Yeah, definitely. There's a very creative element going on, and it's funny how in a way, even though there's nothing subtle about what he's saying, there the humor within it is kind of subtle, because you know, it's not that far removed what some people were writing from as serious lyrics, but you just have to kind of be in on the joke, I guess.
Yeah, and then again, I mean, you mentioned Steel Panther or Spinal Tap again, and it goes straight back that just because maybe there's a bit of role-playing going on in the band and how they're dressed up and wearing Nazi German helmets and iron crosses, and you've got the biker thing going on, you know, that there has to be substance, and it doesn't preclude them from having substance musically just because they've decided to put on a certain facade. You know, I mean, look at Zodiac preening on stage, look at, you know, Cobalt guitar heroing away. He can still play. And Zodiac can still write and play and sing a song. You know, it's still a great album. And, you know, I was listening to it before we started doing this show. And Tattooed Beat Messiah, the song, I just think still a fantastic song. It's just, you know, and like you said, Driving on Holy Gasoline. And I think the third one, if I have to throw one in there, Skull Spark Joker. Always loved it.
It's great.
Yeah, the whole thing drives. You know, from start to finish, the album just kicks it into high gear and goes.
Yeah, Skullspark Joker is killer. One of my favorites is Spasm Gang. I love that song. Planet Girl is really great. Kid Stuff is pretty awesome. I mean, all the way through, it's a really, really strong album. But yeah, they're having a lot of fun with it. But at the same time, like you said, there's a lot of substance here. These are great songs.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I think because it took so long for, you know, the album to come out, is they lost a lot of traction. You know, things had dripped and drabbed over the year before. And in that time, 87 into 88, Guns N' Roses had exploded. The Cult had totally exploded with Electric. And Zodiac was still showing up just in kind of the British press and not making that much of a, you know, a scene on the American side of the Atlantic. So, you know, it's kind of disappointing that you get such a well-produced album, but it was probably too late to build on a lot of the early hype that was attached to the band.
Right, but I think it was a top 20 record in the UK, right? So it was reasonably successful.
Yeah, it did well enough in the UK, but, you know, that's just not enough.
Yeah, and like, and then, you know, even if they had any momentum from this record, they don't put anything out for another three years or whatever. But I guess it was in between that time where, I mean, the highest profile, well, especially in America, the highest profile thing for Zodiac Mind Warp would be Alice Cooper doing Feed My Frankenstein.
Hey, wait a minute. What are we doing?
Yeah, we got backstage passes for Alice Cooper.
So yeah, I guess, I mean, in America, that would be the best known thing associated with Zodiac Mind Warp would just be Feed My Frankenstein.
Yeah, and that's on Alice's Hey Stupid album, so hopefully he at least gets, you know, good residuals from sales on that. But if you're segueing into Hoodlum Thunder, oh my goodness. I mean, if I've got another album that I really, really like, I think I like Hoodlum more than Tattooed.
Really?
Yeah. It's just, again, when we talk about a quantum leap in terms of the sound on Tattooed Beat Messiah, going into Hoodlum Thunder, the songwriting just goes up to the next level. And I love it. Elvis died for you, baby.
I definitely like Tattooed Beat Messiah a lot more. Yeah, Hoodlum Thunder is a good record. But, I mean, 1991, that's pretty late for this kind of stuff already.
Yeah, and by the time, I mean, what, I guess they'd been signed to Phonogram. They owed Phonogram a lot of money. They did demos for Phonogram, though. And those are some of the cool things I managed to add into my collection. I've got an in-house Phonogram demo tape here that's got the demo for Elvis Died For You and an unreleased song called Desolation Boulevard. I think it's also not written down on this, but it's got TV Brain on there as well. So they were definitely still trying to work with Phonogram, but they couldn't get anything released. Let's see. I've got a second demo tape here that's got Trash Madonna, Airline Highway, and Tomorrow Belongs to Love Reaction, and two versions of another unreleased song called Private Hell. Thunder. I mean, I was shocked when I actually found that there was a new Zodiac My Warp album. I mean, by 1992, I'd moved to Scotland. I was going down to the Barrows in Glasgow, and there was actually this record store, and I can't remember where it was. It was down by Glasgow Central, off Argyle Street. But it was an ace little place, and I found that other bands were still making records too, like Wasp. They had Still Not Black Enough there. But I finally found Hoodlum Thunder there. And from the first time I played it, you know, the songs jump out at me. Elvis Died For You, obviously, I've mentioned it. It's stunning. I love it. And the video, I actually saw that on TV in Europe once, just once. And now I have to go to YouTube if I can find it. But again, you know, it's a solid album. I don't think the production's as good as Tattooed Beat Messiah, but I think the songs are stronger. Dr. Jekyll and Me is an absolutely fantastic just piece of rock and roll.
Yeah, that's a great song.
Sneakers must be dancing by the driver on a motorbike. One bad mother, I do what I like.
Your mind is the sexiest part of your body, yeah. Think of me. I'm the dude with the attitude. Dr. Jekyll and me, yeah. I'm the guy with the swirly eyes.
Zodiac's version of Feed My Frankenstein is fantastic. Chainsaw is fantastic. The title track is absolutely epic for me. You know, there's a lot of cool stuff on there. Mean Streak is not one of them for me. Zodiac doing a ballad did not quite work. It's my least favorite song.
Yeah, I think Chainsaw is probably my personal favorite on the record. I think it is kind of a lost album that probably a lot of people would really like, but they don't know about it. I think it's kind of one of those records that could definitely be like a cult classic if more people, discovered it.
Yeah, and being signed to a little French label, and apologies to anyone from France who's listening who says Music Disc is not a little label, but to me it was. It was like, what label is that? But, you know, it was backed by singles. You could find the 12 inches and the CDs for Mean Streak and Elvis in the stores in Britain. I had no problem once I knew there was an album tracking them down in Glasgow. There was the video. There were print ads. So there was enough of a kind of push by the label to get the news of this album out. So it's just a shame that it has become a lost album, because I think if people gave it a chance, and obviously the whole damn thing's probably up on YouTube, so you can go and check it out for yourself if you've never heard it.
Great album title, too. Hoodlum Thunder. But that's very interesting to me. You're talking about those demos you have. So, I mean, that makes sense now that I think about it. Obviously, they were working on another record for Phonogram that, you know, same old story. You know, they were working on it, but it never came out. And so eventually most of those songs they end up using for this, but there's second Phonogram album that didn't happen, huh?
Yeah, it's a real shame. Desolation Boulevard, and you know, you can obviously add a sample of that one in. I mean, it's a really, really good song. Is it suitable for Zodiac Mind Warp? No. I think, like Feed My Frankenstein, if it had been placed with another artist, you know, it could have possibly done well. Though then again, in 1992, you got grunge emerging and kind of rock taking a backseat. But even on that demo tape, it sounds very well produced. You know, it's better than Private Hell, though, that could probably have gone to another artist as well. So, you know, at least he was working on ideas. I would love Mark to actually chime in and, you know, kind of explain the context of both of these demo tapes just to get a better idea of, you know, how they come about, what he was working on, other than the obvious that we know that Phonogram shit on them and they had to just sign with anyone they could to get Hoodlum Thunder released.
Yeah, and Hoodlum Thunder, I start to hear there's a shift in the sound on some of the songs. You know, I hear a lot more like Billy Idol type sounding stuff maybe, and of course the Cult starts creeping in there more on some of the songs. But then it's, you know, some of the songs like Chainsaw still sound a lot like Tattooed Beat Messiah, so there's this kind of mix on there, but there's definitely sort of a shift that keeps happening with My Life Story. Is there a book? Is that a book too?
I think it was, yeah, actually.
But I hear on My Life Story that he starts to almost sound like Iggy Pop or Lou Reed or something on some of that stuff, you know?
Yeah, you know what? The kind of the aggression, the edge has come off the songs. They've become a little bit flat. I don't remember getting this at the time it came out. I think it was quite a few years later that I finally did find a copy. You know, six songs. I hear a little bit of industrial elements starting to creep in terms of the musical. It's just getting away from your guitars and drums, and it's becoming a little bit more sound effects driven, maybe a bit more beats in that kind of sense of it. But it's got some good tracks on it again. I love the revisit of Holy Gasoline on this. Very, very well done. And the other two standouts for me are Slut Freak and Porno Movies. I mean, you know, you still got great titles on here,
yeah.
and it's still fun. And I'll say over Hoodlum Thunder is My Life Story. The song is a better ballad. Zodiac finally nailed a ballad, in my opinion.
You mean the title track?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's softer, melodic, ballady, and happy crappy, and it's way better than Mean Streak.
But that's just kind of a weird little release that I think was kind of a companion piece to the book. Then in 94 we get another... Is One More Knife another Love Reaction album? Or is it credited to something else?
No, that is just billed to Zodiac Mind Warp.
Right. I love Evil Jesus. That's a great song on there. El cuerpo acercándose a Jesús le besó. Jesús le dijo: Judas, con un beso entregas al Hijo del Hombre. Y arrojando las monedas de plata en el templo, se retiró, fue y se ahorcó. We'll be right back.
Yeah, this is darker, but it's also flat. And the problem I always had with it was, you know, it's a little bit too one note in terms of the material. Kind of like all the songs have a similar style, a similar tempo, a similar musicality, but it's darker. If I've got to take my picks off this, you know, Prostitute, Burning Down Your Church, and Avalanche, you know, I think those are great songs. I've mentioned the live album before, but if I could have heard any of those songs on Weapons of Mass Destruction with that guitar sound that Cobalt had, I would have been one very happy person, because right. the production on this album is lacking. And just to hear it raw, rude, aggressive, like that live album presents all the material. Again, these songs, they're decent songs, but I just think they would have benefited from a ballsier production and presentation.
Yeah, I agree. Like, the title track is a cool song. And Storm of Steel is one that maybe would have been awesome to hear the band do live. But yeah, there's just something that, you know, doesn't quite connect, I guess, with a lot of it.
Yeah, Storm of Steel has a really cool, you know, kind of gang vocal in the chorus. And actually, around this time, there was another album that came out, and it was the BBC Live album, Live at Reading, that came out in 93. it's typical BBC live recording. It's flat. BBC is good at sucking all the life out of a performance on their recordings. They either get it great, they do a good job of it, like they have on some of the Def Leppard stuff that's been released, or they do a poor job on it and neuter it.
So then I guess after One More Knife, that's kind of the end at that point, right? Mark Manning must have moved on to different pursuits, I guess. I'm not sure what he did for the rest of the 90s. Do you know?
No. He probably got a job and worked like the rest of us do.
Yeah. But then he makes a comeback in 2002 with I Am Rock, which now we start to get what I hear as a big AC/DC sound on this record, right?
Got AC/DC. You know how AC/DC in the 70s was often considered punk?
Yeah.
Well, that's what I think of I Am Rock, that it's a punky AC/DC. And I was shocked when this one came out too. Was not expecting it. I mean, I'd been following his website in the 90s, hoping beyond hope that something was gonna happen and that there was gonna be another one. But this probably takes it back to, you know, like High Priest of Love, really. It's sleazy gutter rock.
Yeah.
And it's a solid album. You know, anyone who writes a song like Fucked by Rock, you know, that sums it all up. But, you know, it's got some great tracks on it. Shake, Hurricane, and one of my, I guess it's another guilty pleasure, is Helsinki Motorcycles.
Like the night, you got a perfect mouth, you close.
I think Jane in Blue is great. I think that's a great like pop song.
Yeah, and he could write them. That's the whole thing. That I mean, you know, you still get diversity. You get a certain amount of predictability in terms of content, but you know, there's enough flavor and variety on these albums.
And then the Rock Savage album in 2005, I mean, really, just terrible production, I think, is the problem with this. It just it sounds terrible.
Yeah, you know, I really can't find very much positive to say about Rock Savage, that one.
No.
You know, it's a mess. You know, I've been you know, singing the praises of the almighty Zod, you know, for the, you know, 45 minutes now. But Rock Savage, I'm just going to have to take a break from it. And the album didn't work for me. Simple as that. It was great to see that, you know, he was still putting out albums. And it was nice as well, you know, when he put out Rock Savage, they reissued I Am Rock. The downside was is that the reissue supposedly had 4 demos on it, and there was nothing on the frickin' CD, so was not amused, and that probably made me hate Rock Savage.
Oh, so they were listed on the as tracks, but then when you put the CD in, they're not there.
Yeah, it was the same label, Cosmodelic or something like that, or Cosmo Candlelight, whatever. But you're supposed to have demos of Fuck by Rock, The King of Love, Jane and Blue, and 20,000 Women. I was like, okay, cool, you know, gonna have that for me. Nope, nothing on there. That's all right. That's fine.
Oops.
So I didn't even bother taking any notes on that. Yeah, you know, shit happens.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I was listening back through these albums, I was like, I'm not listening to that. It never liked it. Never worked for me.
So then there's another 7-year break before he comes out with something else in 2012 called We Are Volsung, or Volsung, however you say that, which very garage rock sounding record.
Yeah, I mean, this is like MC5, Iggy, and all that, you know, 60s. Yeah. You know, it's obviously got it's kind of a concept album, I guess, because, you know, it's got the Norse theme going through it. I liked it. Again, I'm always happy when I see a new Zodiac Mind Warp album in a record store, because it's just one of those things that make me happy. But, you know, it is more garagey. Like the title track a lot, like Stark Van Oben, and We Ride.
Oh,
I think We Ride is probably my favorite song on there. But I really thought the concept of Tree Rider was cool because he's talking about like being lynched or being hung from a tree, and that's a tree rider, somebody hanging from a tree. I thought that was an interesting image.
Yeah, but that's typical Zodiac, yeah. You know, tree rider. Okay.
I think that's like he says, your nuns will worship me, which that's a nice Zodiac line.
So there's a couple of other releases in that period as well. One that came out in 2008 was, I think it was released by Haggis, and that is Pandora's Grizzly Handbag. And it's an archive of the band from 1985-86. And you can score this one up on eBay. And it's got a live album of the band playing in 1986. So it's got all the early shit. Wow. Yeah, it's got Drug Shoes. It's got Psychoactive. It's got the very obscure Purple Beef Originator, early version of Spasm Gang, and The Rocker. So second disc is a DVD. It's got some early TV stuff. Quality is not the greatest, but, you know, if you're actually buying an archival Zodiac Mind Warp release, I don't think you're really going to care that it's not BBC quality. It gives you a picture of the band in the era, and it's really cool. The other really cool one, and I got to say, Weapons of Mass Destruction, that's the third time I've mentioned this, is one of my all-time favorite live albums. And that kind of stuns me when I think of the other stuff that I like, you know, the Iron Maiden Live After Death, the Judas Priest, Unleashed from the East. This album is just one of the most aggressive sounding live albums I've listened to. I absolutely love the guitar tone throughout this album and what it does for all of the songs. I mean, it's got a ton of stuff from I Am Rock. It's got quite a few of the High Priest of Love. It gives them balls. I mean, if you thought those songs were tough on the original albums, find a copy of Weapons, because, you know, I think I had to pay like $40 for the CD on eBay, and it was worth every cent. Getting this thing in my car, you know, and just listening to this whole freaking album over and over, it's just really fun, and it reminds me of all the reasons why I liked Zodiac Mind Warp in the first time. Decent tunes, aggressive music, and tongue-in-cheek humor. So, great, great, great live album.
Momento, momento, un momentito, por favorcito. Te tengo una historia que quiero contar con este hijo de tu chingada madre, Zodiac, man.
I don't fucking understand
loco.
Either.
He thinks
fucking
you don't...
Mexican asshole. I don't fucking...
Parece que quiere un poco de magic. No sabe nada de magic, man.
Just play with your lizard, cat. Play with your lizard.
Zodiac Mind Warp is obscure, and a lot of people have not heard of him, or maybe they only remember their MTV youth of where they saw the Prime Mover video. You know, there's more to it. There's more to it than Backseat Education. There's more to it than Planet Girl. I mean, those are the big, I guess, the singles from the Tattoo Beat Messiah era. You know, if you lost track of him after that, get on YouTube, go and check out Elvis Died For You, check out Weapons of Mass Destruction. There is a lot more of a catalog by a band that is, you know, a guy who's continued to make music without getting necessarily any of the artistic recognition for keeping trying. And that's something I respect, a musician who makes music. And fuck it all if it's not a platinum album. You know, he keeps making music. And a lot of it has been, you know, a soundtrack that I've enjoyed throughout the years. So, you know, if I could say anything to Zodiac directly, Mark Manning, thank you very much for the music. Fucking love it. Hope you're going to, you know, get Cobalt and make some more noise.
Yeah, I love bands with an image. I love bands with a persona. You know, I love the idea of, taking on a character and just having a lot of fun with being a rock band. And, you know, I think that's one of the things that is really sadly missing from modern music. It's just that element of just, you know, having an image and a persona and just being a rock and roll band and having fun with it. And, you know, there's just a lot more elements than just the music. And I don't see why there's anything wrong with that. You know, there was this whole backlash against that in the 90s. And it's just kind of held on, but that's one of my favorite things about rock and roll is the image and just the obnoxious flamboyance of a rock band. So, I mean, I really appreciate all of that kind of stuff that Zodiac Mind Warp were doing and having fun with.
Yeah, and that's the fun thing. Here we are now. You know, I'm sitting here looking at that 10-inch stack of CDs next to me that we just talked about, you know, or the pile of vinyl that's down on my floor by my feet. Holy crap. I mean, that's a lot of releases. That's a lot of music by someone who no one's probably heard of.
Yeah, I have to think that, especially with, you know, the core albums of Tattooed Beat Messiah and Hoodlum Thunder, there's a lot of people who would be huge fans of those records that just don't know about them because, you know, they're really as good as it gets. They're just as good as almost anything else from the era and the genre. You know, the songs are there.
Yeah, and back in the 1980s, you know, when all this stuff was coming out, for the collector in me, it was fun. It was a great time. It's like, there's another 12-inch single. What, does it have any B-sides on it? Okay. Yeah, it does. You know, and that was the same thing for Hoodlum Thunder. So you end up with nearly as much of a catalog from just B-sides with Zodiac Mind Warp, you know, Whore of Babylon.
Yeah, that was the thing about the UK bands that was different is you could always put together another album just from the B-sides. Like, I have a whole bunch of Dogs the Moor stuff, or like the Wild Hearts had a ton of, I mean, just insane B-sides. That was like a UK thing to have all those, a whole collection of B-sides that would turn into another record just as good as the record that the singles were from, you know?
Yeah, I don't know if you can say that of the Zodiac Mind Warp B-sides, but
but it's still fun to collect. I mean, that was another thing about record collecting back then was, you know, collecting B-sides, and here you just have more songs to go out and get, and it's just fun. It's like a treasure hunt, always.
Yep, and not being afraid to, you know, make music. It's just, you know, fuck around in the studio and put it out. Or have an idea, or be artistic, whatever. Who knows what the reasons are behind, or the motivations are behind some of the songs, but, you know, good for them. And that's all I say.
Yeah. Yeah, but we might not recommend the books as much. You might not want to shell out too much money on Amazon for the books.
Yeah, you might want to enter a different dimension when reading or attempting to read those books.
Yeah.
And I don't know, has he reissued any of those on Kindle? That might be something worth checking, and if he hasn't, if he hasn't, he probably should.
Yeah, right. Well, speaking of books, did you ever think about doing a Zodiac Mind Warp book yourself?
No, there's not a market,
yeah.
there's not enough in it, and you know why? You know, I spent a lot of time editing all the pages on Wikipedia for Zodiac, and I was like adding in these, adding in those, and adding in lots of shit. And, you know, I don't mind when people go back and edit my stuff, but when your post that you've taken time for, you know, to create gets flagged by Wikipedia, and it says this topic or article may not meet Wikipedia's notability guideline for music. Well, how dare you? Fuck you. Zodiac Mind Warp is indeed notable, Wikipedia. So they've deleted lots of the pages that I've written, and it annoys me. So I guess if Wikipedia doesn't think there's a market for writing on Zodiac Mind Warp, I'm not going to waste my time trying to write something.
Really? They do that? They say this is not enough people know about this to have it on Wikipedia?
Yeah, they've got a notability guideline for music.
That's crazy. You would think they would want... I mean, these are records that exist. Why wouldn't they want it to be written about on there? That's crazy.
I find it annoying and offensive that they kind of pretend to be an encyclopedia, but there's knowledge that they don't want. Are we not preserving all knowledge?
Yeah, exactly.
You know what? I know that you have to have verifiability and notability, but the criteria has to be flexible, because say someone just wants to find out something, there should be a source for it. You know, there should be one source. And if Wikipedia wants to be that one source, then they need to broaden their, you know, their metrics, whatever the fuck they want to call them, their criteria.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's just a personal peeve. I'm more annoyed about it that I took the time to write stuff and they deleted it. And I hate being deleted.
Yeah, well, that sucks, and that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But so when does the Odyssey book come out then?
Odyssey book will be out. When will it be out? September 16th. Hope to have pre-orders up in the next few days. I'm working with a couple of distributors that are making this a challenge because we're going to have domestic copies available in Australia and Canada this time, and it just makes things a little bit more complex. So it is coming. Tim is actively promoting the hell out of it on the Facebook page, so he's got a lot of really fun posts queued up. So if you're checking us out, it's Odyssey Elder Book on Facebook, or Kiss Odyssey on the web will take you to the same place. And we're ready. I'm finished all the editing on it. The copy editor's done now. Got some pictures in there, so anyone who's got a comp right now, you're like, pictures? What pictures? Yeah, there weren't any pictures in the versions that went out to everyone. So very excited to get that one done. Then I'll probably move on to the next book.
Well, and we're talking about like a comprehensive history of the making of Music from the Elder, right?
Oh, it's as comprehensive as we could get. Obviously, there are some people who you'd love to interview, but are not going to talk unless they get paid, or are just not willing to talk, or don't want to talk to you because they don't like you. So it's comprehensive. There are a ton of interviews with a whole bunch of, you know, interesting people, whether it's on the record label side, whether it's on the songwriting side, the performing side. It's about as in-depth, I think, as we can get.
Well, I can't think of many books I'd rather read than a book about Music from the Elder, so I'm excited about this one.
You know, I don't think you could pick a more obscure album, even within a well-known band's catalog. Anyone who's heard of Kiss would, you know, who isn't really a Kiss fan has probably never heard of The Elder, and so they'll have no idea what on earth we're doing writing a 536-page
book. Holy shit. Awesome. All right, well, thank you so much, Julian, for talking to me about Zodiac Mind Warp, and we'll definitely have to find some other ridiculously obscure topic to talk about at some point in the future for another episode. I'd love to have you back on, so thanks a lot for doing this.
Thank you, BJ, for having me on the show. It's been a blast, as always, and I certainly hope you can think of something obscure that I've heard of as well.
I'll try.
Special car, honey. Smooth accelerators. No brakes. Yeah! Come on. You wanna know about love, baby? Let me teach ya. Come to church. I'm the preacher. Jump in the motor like a Jesus Cascade. I'm the love commando. This is a raid. The brothers in art, baby. I'm so real. Would you buy my
And now, to play us out.
What does that mean, to play us out? I don't know what that means, to play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
So I guess let's end this episode with the title track from the classic Zodiac Mind Warp and the Love Reaction album from 1988. Killer, killer album called Tattooed Beat Messiah. Till next time.
That ain't no garbage, man, baby. That's Slam Thunder. I catch you on the phone.
crystal clear. I got a diamond shot. Kill your drops, baby, I'm red hot. Lots of girls try, they lie and die. Got too close to the starry hose. Grease, baby, dirt, trash, sex appeal. Zip, fly, pop, I freak you, you'll kill me.
Be back.